Chinook. It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, and today we conclude our discussion of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. We've been talking to Jerry Macbeth of the Political Science Department at the University of Alaska. Previously, we had noted that political leaders are not always the best corporation executives, and that while some of the regional corporations are showing profits, others are not. And that brings us to the question, can a regional corporation go bankrupt?
Theoretically, yes. It doesn't seem likely in the immediate future. There are two problems. One is that each native corporation has land, or some land.
Mm-hmm.
Some have more than others, of course, but if a corporation is losing a lot of money on its investments, it's still not touching its basic reserve in land that is worth millions of dollars. I mean, the land that Doyon earns is worth about $2 billion now.
But are they able to dispose of that?
And they can't dispose of it, so that means that they can't really go bankrupt yet. Land cannot be sold until 1992, that is 20 years after the passage of the Act. And it's, of course, possible that this deadline could be extended by Congress. Second, there is under ANCSA a so-called shared wealth provision. This is Section 7I that provides that 70% of the profits or the benefits gained by any one corporation will be spread among the other corporations. And that this was put in the Act initially to sort of balance out the money and land among the native corporations. Each would return 30% and passing on 70%. Well, this has provoked a whole legal hassle, and it's now tied up in the courts, and those corporations that have made profits on investments have not shared them with sister corporations to this point. But at least it is a guard against bankruptcy, or so it is said, that other corporations would then kick in through the shared wealth provision. I think it's unlikely that my personal attitude, my feeling is that the Act will be amended to make it unlikely that the corporations will go bankrupt in the century, at least. That there's a lot riding on these corporations becoming successful. Now, by the other hand, I've talked with the senators and representatives who've said that's it, that they don't think it will be amended. I think at this point there are arguments on both sides. But it's a political business. It's possible to stage a second campaign that mm-hmm. would successfully amend the Act. Because this is, especially this business of selling land after 1991 is a very troublesome one. The land is valuable. Individuals who are old now and would like some personal gain and benefit from the Act would like to sell their land mm-hmm. and live well for the remaining years of their life. On the other hand, their sale of that land will presumably not benefit the community, at least in its ability to determine how that land will be used.
So that part could be amended and extended.
But it's possible, yes.
Now what about this shared wealth? I'm not sure I understood all that. That's in the Act itself that
yes.
they have.
Yeah, okay. Section
where does that
Act.
Money go, that 30%
well,
of the...
No, it simply provides that if a corporation is profitable,
uh-huh.
that the profits of the corporation will be shared on a 30-70 ratio. That is, the corporation making the profit will retain 30% and 70% will be distributed among other corporations.
It doesn't say how many other corporations or to which
well,
ones.
There are 12. Well, 13 with the
so
answer.
Equally, they each yes. get equal shares.
As I suggested, the corporations have been challenged on this point. A case in point is ASRC, which has made profits and has not declared a profit to be shared. Right? Well, there's a question of whether it's gross or net, right? Mm-hmm. And a series of other ways of interpreting so that there is no surplus to be spread among other corporations. But I think that the act itself is written in such a way that it's an invitation to interpretations, in questioned interpretations of how benefits will be distributed.
One other question is that I'm told that there are several interpretations of the act, and that in order to understand it, you not only have to ask, you have to ask a political scientist, you have to ask Native leaders, you have to ask Native stockholders, you have to ask lawyers. Is there that much room for doubt and so much of it?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how to answer it directly. I think any act, or most acts of Congress, permit a lot of interpretation. That's how we keep our federal court system busy. They are sufficiently, if they're at all general, they have to be written in a fashion that's relatively ambiguous.
And what are some of the issues that are being taken with it?
Well, one issue that I've mentioned is the shared wealth provision. Mm-hmm. That's an important one. Another is the conveyance of land to regional corporations and village corporations. For instance, by 1974, village corporations were to have selected lands and within a year or so thereafter to have received lands selected. Regional corporations within 4 years, 1974, were to have selected lands and shortly thereafter to have received these lands. These lands were to have been conveyed to them and patented to them. Well, the conveyances have not proceeded on time or on a timely basis, which means that the Native corporations, both regional and village, have not yet received the bulk of the lands that were allocated to them under the Act. This, then, is a problem that affects the whole timetable. It gives the Native corporations a ground to argue that the 1991 date of expiration, right, of land sales can be extended if they have not, in fact, received their lands. Mm-hmm. Also, another matter is pertaining to the 2% royalty on state and federal mineral exploitation and exploration in the state that has not proceeded as quickly as anticipated. In other words, the first half of the payments out of the federal treasury, have come into the coffers of the regional corporations, but the money from through state and federal leasing and royalty oils has not. Again, this is partly because of the question of pipeline tariffs, and another complicated issue. So that these are issues relating to the interpretation of the Act.
Are they being argued now in court, or is they just issues up in the air?
No, these are issues. Each of the issues I've mentioned is something that has been a lawsuit of a Native corporation against the federal government, the Interior Department, against the state of Alaska. The state has joined on the issue of mineral revenues. The state has joined some regional corporations in a suit against the federal government. Other issues or matters of complexity relate to the matter of, this is an earlier question now almost settled, what a village was, whether a village had enough people to be a fully entitled village or not. Matters of the trespass suit that was filed before the land claim settlement was passed. In other words, what happens, what about lands that were trespassed on by oil companies and state agency officials before the Act was passed? This is a suit involving billions of dollars worth of damage that is now on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have by no means given a complete list of the question interpretations of the Act.
At this point, our formal discussion of ANCSA came to an end. But before turning off the tape recorder, I asked Professor Macbeth if I'd left out any important questions.
That's a nice opener. If the question is, the impact of the Act, well, then I think that just looking at it as a how the lives, the political futures of an important group have been changed, that it's clearly a major piece of national legislation. The ANCSA itself and the corporation concept is one that can in fact change a culture, depending on how it is approached and how it's used. These make it interesting to me, but it's just because I can analyze one thing doesn't mean I have no opinions about it. I do, and I've lived with and talked with natives about these matters for a number of years, and I can see that it has had serious ramifications on the day-to-day lives of native peoples. It is a form of social and political engineering and tinkering, and I'm not so sure that I like this. I'm not so sure that we, all of us, meaning natives and non-natives, knew enough about this business before the act was drawn. Of course, we can never know enough, but whether we had the critical knowledge, and whether the critical knowledge is there and in the act, and in the guidelines from the act, so that natives will be able to design their future, will be protected in the design of their future, in the way that we would wish. So that there are these questions about the act and the land claims movement always come up when I consider it, and they're very troubling ones.
Mm-hmm. Almost like it's could get away from all of us, having started its
topsy-turvy, yes.
Yeah, not in anybody's hands.
No.
Jerry Macbeth of the University of Alaska Political Science Department. And for Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Echoes. I'm Paula Schiller. And today, the story behind the stories. A conversation with Karen McPherson, director of the Alaska Native Oral Literature Project. She tells of the collecting and recording of over 700 stories and songs from dozens of villages. But first, a little background.
Well, the Alaska Native Oral Literature Project began in fall of 1972. It was funded initially in July, but we got going a few months later through the Alaska Federation of Natives, our original funds. And the purpose was to collect stories, oral traditions from around the state, that is, from around native areas of the state, to go out into the field with professional recording equipment and not GE 1995 cassettes, and to record people in their environments, preferably in the native language, with the stories, the songs that they had in them, that they remembered from when they were children and that they ideally were passing on to future generations.
We're talking about stories, not histories, not factual events. We're talking about culture. We're talking about...
Yeah, we're talking about what perhaps in our construct we'd refer to as myths, as mythology and legends and that sort of thing. We did, of course, collect some stories, some histories, that is, and that many people, when asked for stories, their stories were personal histories. And that wasn't excluded. I wouldn't say to somebody, or a field worker wouldn't say to somebody, well, I'm sorry, we don't want that story.
It's too personal.
Whatever, because we got some fascinating historical information. One of the things that was especially interesting was that there's a large history of Eskimo Indian wars in the state in different groups. And we got some stories, some Quechin stories from Arctic Village of wars with the Nunavut Eskimos. And then we got to Anaktuvik Pass and got Nunavut stories of the wars with the Quechin. And they're two different points of view on the same altercations. And that's fascinating, that kind of thing.
That's fascinating to the people that have access to this, to the tapes, who can go back and sort through that and compare them. To the people telling the stories, they would have no way of comparing those two stories.
Not at that time, but usually you'd say to somebody, hey, you know, we've got another story, you know, from another point of view on something you just told us about. And we could, if somebody wanted to give us like a blank cassette, we'd dub it and we'd send them a copy. But the problem there is that about 80% of our material was in the native language of the storyteller. So it didn't do a great deal of good for an Inupiaq speaker to get a Quechin story, but we did get about 40%, I think, of the collection translated by the end of the year of the project. And it was only a year-long project.
So you have, in the archives, there are tapes available in the various languages and also translations of many of them.
Right.
Are any of the stories originally in English?
Yeah, about, I'd say we collected about 700 pieces, and of those, maybe 20% are in English, yeah. It for various reasons. Sometimes a person just was more comfortable in English, or I guess that would be the main reason why somebody would do it. Some people didn't use the language that they had used as a child. Most of our storytellers were like over 60 years old, and most of them did feel much more fluent in their native language. But occasionally there was someone who didn't. That was rare. Some of the neat things that we got are people that would translate themselves. There was a woman in Holy Cross, and we got recorded some Holokachuk stories there, as well as some Ingalik stories. And I'd never heard Holokachuk before. And it was fantastic. And she was the best storyteller. You know, I could be in trouble for saying this in the whole project. She was amazing, absolutely amazing. And you listened to her, and I'd never heard Holokachuk before and didn't understand a word. And I could have sworn I knew what she was saying. And then she turned around and translated herself in perfect English. I mean, she was an amazing lady. Also an amazing basket maker.
Did you, in fact, know what she was saying, or?
Yeah, I mean, there enough of it from her body language and her tones and stuff have been conveyed that, I mean, clearly I couldn't have given a literal translation, but some of the ideas, yeah, were there.
What do you think, though, about having an old story, a traditional story told in English that already involves translation by the storyteller? Doesn't that some way affect the content? Is it accurate? Is it good material for an archivist to have?
I think it's better than having no material at all, and there's absolutely no trade-off there, and that some storytelling traditions, not one word can be changed, or the storyteller has blown it. They're no storyteller. But in many of the traditions up here, especially, it seems, the Athabascan traditions, there is no need for an exact repetition each time a story is told. It can change. And that the gist of the story has to be there, but not word per word. And so given that that is allowed to change, I don't see that there's any problem with the translation where some things are allowed to change.
Historically, the stories serve purposes partly to entertain during long evenings, because there's no TV, partly to instruct. Can you outline some of the reasons for the stories?
Well, given that not even that many years ago in the state, there were no schools, per se, no formal modes of education, and that people's schools were, in effect, informal, that a person would transmit knowledge to another person largely by example, by what they did, and other people would watch and pick up the information. The other way was also even more informal, which was through stories, not a direct way of transmitting nitty-gritty knowledge, but still information you had to have to live within that society, and that a culture has certain ways of believing and operating, and to transmit those beliefs and operant modes to other people, there are many ways to do it. One of them is through stories, and through a quasi-fictional account, it's possible to transmit to someone a lot of things that would be very difficult to just come out and say, like don't rat on somebody or help other people. Well, that's pretty bald. But if you have Raven, say, tricking someone out of their oldest daughter, and then, you know, gets found out, well, that's pretty clear, you mm-hmm. know, what's going on there.
Is there any way of judging the
the popularity of the different kinds of stories? Is there?
Yeah. That's a kind of neat thing, is that when you travel around the state, you'll hear some stories almost in every area, the same story, almost exactly the same story. And some are area-specific or group-specific. But there are certain stories, the Raven Cycle, for instance. Many of the Raven stories are told, it seems, statewide, and that's not just this state. You could go parts of the lower 48 states or Canada and find the same story that's going around. Or even in other groups, you can go to Africa and find some stories, for instance, that are very much like Alaskan stories. Certain stories, in terms of popularity, people love. I mean, we'll tell over and over again. You go to one village, and there'll be several people that will have that story. And maybe only, you know, one person will have a certain story, a particular story, for various reasons. Some stories are funny, incredibly funny. And some of the funny stories, which are also give a lot of messages, are very popular. And other times, some stories are very long. And it's the really long stories that seem to be the hardest, or at that time were the hardest to record, partially because people weren't quite willing to spend that amount of time, say, like 3 days to tell a story.
3 days?
3 days.
For one story?
Mm. And
especially for an older person, they would be the ones that would be telling the story.
Right. Like an hour and a half was about the longest story that we collected, and there are several of them.
Can you tell me, is there perhaps with the new interest, with the people wanting to look at their roots, is there maybe a new storytelling? Are there any new stories being generated at all, or is it the old ones?
There are a lot of the category, I think, of personal accounts, personal hunting and trapping experiences as an informational, as an instructional tool. A lot of that, I think, still going on. But there are a lot of projects now in schools, like quasi-Foxfire projects, where kids are encouraged to go out in the communities and interview people and collect stories. Fantastic. Okay, things are going to be recorded. The only problems there is what's going to happen to those tapes, and are they going to be usable? And what is the quality of the tape? Again, I had the attitude for a while that having a cassette copy of a story was as bad as not having it at all. I mean, it was the equivalent of not having it. That has been modified so that having it at all is certainly better than not having it, you know.
Okay, can you give us a recap of exactly what the project has and where we can hear these things, or how available are they?
Okay, the project has about 700 stories and songs. They are all the master tapes are seven-inch reels. They're in the University of Alaska archives. They are not available for checkout, however. But the Alaska Library Association, which was kind of the sponsoring organization for the project, made cassette dubs of maybe 400, I don't know exactly how many, pieces of material. And those are available by sending a blank tape to the Alaska State Library in Juneau. And you will get back a copy of what you want. The way you can access that is there's a catalog called Stories and Legends, or Alaskan Stories and Legends, available out of the Alaska State Library in Juneau. Get the copy of the catalog. You can look through it either by specific location, by storyteller, by language, or by story title, which is, again, somewhat arbitrary, story title, and pick out what you want, send in your blank cassette, and get it back.
Karen McPherson, director of the Alaska Native Oral Literature Project. For Chinook Echoes, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.